more about your life in Aspen and about life in Aspen in general. And as we begin, I wonder if you have any thoughts or feelings about making this tape.
I like to make it. I think it should be things, our ideas should be really preserved for the future. We have lived through Aspen at a time which we cherish. It has changed so tremendous. We have changed with it. Most of it we like, some things we don't. But this is the most terrific town. I wouldn't want to live anyplace else. That's for sure.
Let's begin.
Yeah.
What is your full name now?
My full name is Margaret Uhl.
And is Gretel a
That's
nickname?
That's the short. Margaret Gretel.
And have you been known as Gretel your entire life?
My entire life.
And what was your maiden name?
Hartl.
And
a tongue twister. Gretel Hartl.
And the date of your birth?
It was November 3rd, 1923.
And where were you
Germany.
Born?
In Germany.
What part of Germany?
In Bad Tölz, but I am from Partenkirchen. Just was born there.
And the town that you lived in, what part of Germany is that in?
It's Bavaria, and it's the southernmost part. Our mountainside is still German or Bavarian. The big side is Austrian already.
Let's talk a little bit about some of your background growing up before we meet you in Aspen. Could you tell us a little something about your childhood in Germany and your early experiences skiing as a child?
Yeah, I was very lucky. My parents had a restaurant within the Olympic ski stadium in Garmisch-Partenkirchen. I was exposed to skiing at an early age. So on my sixth birthday, I received my first pair of skis. And after having the jumping hills in front of us, my skiing consisted mainly of shoeing, straight down. And I have always liked speed ever since.
Do you remember what those first skis looked like?
They were wooden skis, no edges naturally. Just a very simple leather binding. Skis bent up in front. Ski poles, very big baskets. But it worked.
And you said you like to go right down, straight down.
I loved shoeing. Just loved it.
Did the rest of your family ski also?
My father skied. My mother hated it. So did my sister.
And anything else about your early childhood, your young years as a girl in Germany?
Yeah, I was, again, it was so lucky to grow up actually outside of town. It's, we had, our walk was about half an hour to school, summer and winter. Our neighborhood, the closest neighbor was about 10 minutes from our house, and she still is my very closest, oldest friend, Ulla Echtler, wonderful person, held for a whole lifetime. It was a family of nine, and my sister and myself envied them, because we always wanted to have more children around the house, but no luck.
And she lives in Germany?
She lives in Garmisch, yeah.
Well, you just mentioned that your parents had a restaurant in the Olympic...
Within the stadium.
Within the stadium. What was that restaurant like?
It was not a cafeteria, it was a regular coffee hartl. With a big terrace, it's beautiful in the Swiss style. My parents had it from 1923 until 1939. And after my parents were absolute 100% anti-Nazi, they had a terrific hard time. My father was drafted early, so the house could be confiscated. He wasn't in the way. My mother had to fight the whole battle by herself. It was quite a hard time for my parents. My mother had actually a nervous breakdown because of it. And they never went back into the restaurant business. This was it. But it certainly was what we called a gold grube, because it was right on the entrance to to the Partnachklamm, which is a gorge, and the end of the the parking lot for all the cars, the garden looking into the ski stadium, couldn't have been a more ideal location for a business.
I'd like to ask you more about the restaurant, but I'm very interested in what you were saying about the war.
Yeah.
You were a teenager during the time.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you could want to say anything else about your experiences during the war.
And by being in Garmisch, which was so far removed from the war, really, the major hurt was really to lose so many of my schoolmates in their best age, in the best age. It was really terrible. That hit home. And otherwise, naturally, the restriction in food, it was so poor and so terrible, one cannot imagine anymore. This is why I always say, no matter what, my house will be filled with good food at all times, and it is.
Let's talk a little bit more about the restaurant. Your parents started it the year you were born, 1923. So you grew up with your parents in the restaurant. And did you participate at all? Did you help? Did you play there? What did you do?
We were not allowed to, except in 1936 when we had the Olympic Winter Games, which was right there in front of us. And it was the first time my parents allowed me to take in the bons, which are the orders of the waitresses and so on. That was my checking point. I did that. I did this through the 13 days. And I loved it. I always loved to be connected. It was just, in Europe, it really wasn't, or not my family, not period, it wasn't allowed. We were not allowed to work in it because we seemed to be underfoot, and that was just out.
Do you think by watching your parents in the restaurant, and did your mother cook?
No, she couldn't. My mother couldn't even cook. I think all my mother could make in her whole life, and she never tried any better, was some goulash and a pound cake. And she left it at that.
Well, how do you think your love of cooking began?
Because I wasn't allowed to. I just wanted to so badly. I enjoyed so much working with food and with my hands, and I enjoyed it so much to see people eating it.
And enjoying it.
Enjoying it, yeah.
So if we move forward just a little bit, in 1948 you married Sepp Uhl, your husband.
Yeah.
What is his full name, or what was his full name?
Joseph Uhl.
And Sepp was a nickname?
That's the short of Joseph.
And how did the two of you meet?
I was invited by Erich Windisch, who is now supervisor in Vail, who was Nordic master in Germany, to a ski instructor's party. And that's the very first ski instructor's party I went to, and met Sepp there. And I must say, we just liked each other. But it took a whole year of courting to convince me that this was the man I wanted to marry, because I should have been engaged to somebody from Freiburg who was an architect and the absolute the favorite of my parents. And here all of a sudden comes Sepp, who was absolutely not accepted. And that was, we have a marriage picture book, and it shows very clearly in it why we came to the United States.
Gretel, I want to come back to that. I realize I skipped something very important, and
yeah.
Then I want to come back to your early relationship with Sepp and his skiing background and then the marriage. But I realize I forgot to ask you about your involvement in skiing as you got older. So yeah. Can you fill that in for us?
I raced the very first time by accident, really, in 1939. Somebody didn't show up. I was standing up there. Close to the starting gate, watching the whole procedure. And they said, so-and-so hasn't shown up. Please put that number around you and go. And I thought, my God, all I can do is go straight. And so I won it. It was my first experience. But later then in 1941, I have all the sheets, all the result sheets, everything with me here. I started raising against Austria, mainly because we didn't have much choice during the war. And the first time again, internationally, in 1951, Garmisch hosted the first international winter sports week, and that's also the time I met Stein Eriksen, Zeno Kolo. Our ski club Partenkirchen gave a wonderful banquet, and this was the time I was introduced to all these men.
So you began racing in 1949 or something like that?
Actually, in 41.
41, I'm in. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. I made a mistake.
Yeah.
And then, now we'll bring us back to meeting Sepp, and it sounds like it was a mutual attraction between the two of you. You both liked each other.
And we decided to get married to the upset of not just my parents, but actually half of the town. I received, and I still have them, I received two anonymous letters saying that people are disappointed in me and so on, and I couldn't understand it. Anyway, we went ahead.
What was the reason why people were so upset about your getting married? Do you want
to
talk about
Sepp, it? Because he was a ski instructor. I wasn't allowed to marry a ski instructor, and here I ended up being one myself.
Were ski instructors looked down on there?
Well, they were kind of womanizers and so on, so not to be trusted, and it wasn't a profession really at that time.
And was his background in racing also, or before he started
teaching? No. Sepp had gone to the Art Academy in Strasbourg originally. He's quite an artist, and he became a ski instructor because he worked immediately for the American Army when he came back out of the war. And it was mainly for the food at that time, because food was too scarce, so you had to do something which brought food. Mm-hmm. And that's how his skiing profession really started.
And he was an artist at heart?
That, definitely.
Where did you live when you first married him?
My parents have a beautiful house in Garmisch, and we needed an apartment, and there was a empty apartment at the top of our house. So we took our two places we had and asked my parents if we could rent that place, which we did. And at this time I was working in an office, and the client I had was a man from Hamburg who was so nice. He wanted to give me something special for my wedding, and I asked him to get a counter, a measure for our electricity, so we would be independent from our parents, because whatever we did, we wanted to pay for and just be regular renters in our house, which we were.
And soon after that, your daughter was born.
Renata was born 2 years after we got married. She's born 1950, and she's born in our house because I ran away out of the hospital. Couldn't stand it to be in a hospital room with four or three other ladies who were in labor. So I just, after everybody left, I just went quietly out of the hospital, took the bus home, and had my baby at home.
Did you have any help there?
I called a midwife on the way home. Before I entered the bus, I called our midwife, and she was so nice to come. And my doctor was on vacation at the time, but he did come the next day. Anyway, Renata was born in the house.
And was that unusual in Germany in those days?
To certain families, it was unusual.
I won't ask how your parents felt about that.
They couldn't believe it.
Well, not too long after your daughter was born, you came to the United States and to Aspen. What happened in between?
Again, we have a whole book about that. My parents, disliking Sepp the way they did, made life a little hard for us. And luckily, Willy Scheffler, Tony Wernley, who also came to Aspen, and my husband were close friends. Willy left in 49, Tony Wernley in 51. And we wrote back and forth, and the American consul in Munich, who was also a close friend of ours, Mr. Becky, he said, Gretel, go, do it now, you will not regret it. So we made arrangements to come and left on the Mauritania British ship to New York and took the train out to Glenwood Springs. We were picked up in Glenwood Springs by Tony Wernley and Carl Hoffman, brought to Aspen, and that's it.
Before we find out what your first impressions of Aspen were, what kinds of things did they tell you in the letters that you wrote back and forth about this town in Colorado?
To me, it seemed that everybody ate only elk and deer, which didn't agree with Sepp at all. He said, there must be a butcher there. There must be something normal there. Naturally, it was. It was Bacon Bishop. But still, most people lived from elk and deer. Anyway, I imagined it the Wild West. I must say, I wasn't disappointed. The roads were not paved when we got picked up. The town was... The houses were halfway falling down. Lots of shacks around. And it was culture shock the first few days. But on the other hand, I was so glad that nobody could call me. Nobody said, oh, Renata is crying, or what did you do today? You cannot hang the laundry out. You cannot do this. You cannot do this. It was just wonderful.
So you were really on your own here?
Yeah.
You described Aspen as being very different from the town you had grown up in. And what about the social atmosphere? As you got to know it a little bit in the early 50s, what was it? What were people like to this newcomer from Germany?
They were so generous, you cannot believe it, in every way. They helped, and that includes Mrs. Shaw.
And who is Mrs. Shaw?
Mrs. Shaw is the lady who owned most of the houses, and we rented the first year the house on Main Street from Mrs. Shaw. She, and next to us were the Presnitzes, Kurt and Laurie Presnitz, who were Alpine Schuler. They were my first neighbors. Everybody was so helpful, from lending us things until our whole stuff came, to showing us how to do things here, how to proceed. It was unbelievable, and it still is. I don't see any difference there. People are plain generous and very loving and very giving.
Anything else about what Aspen looked like in those days? Did you find Beck and Bishop eventually, the market that is where the Wheeler is, in the Wheeler?
Right. There was another one very close to us, which was the Mesa store. And Elizabeth, I forgot her last name now, owned it. So it was convenient to go over there. But at Beck and Bishop, there was B, and she... I came in with a piece of paper writing down everything I wanted because my pronunciation wasn't right. So she was so nice, took that piece of paper and went with me through the whole aisles, showing me where it is and what it is called. And also I was a little bit appalled because we couldn't get good sausage or good salami or yogurt or good cheese. It was all just American cheese, hamburger, white bread. But Beckin Bishop, Albert, was so nice. He ordered certain things. He said, I don't know if we can sell it. But I said, anything good can be sold. Mm-hmm. And he really improved from every shopping, from one shopping to the next. We found what we needed.
In 1953, when you arrived, the skiing industry was still in its infancy, although it had begun in the late 40s.
Very much so.
Can you describe what you remember about what the mountain looked like and what the ski school was like at the beginning, when you first got here?
That first winter of 53, when it got toward Christmas, at the height of it, there were 17 instructors teaching, and maybe a few helping hands, but basically 17 that took care of the customers very easy. We had our meetings at the Hotel Charon, and our meeting place was right across from it, which was Ellis. We congregated in the afternoon in the Blue Room. That was fun. The mountain itself was not groomed. There was no such things. Eventually there was a packing crew, but we always had a good ski patrol right from the beginning. And again, everybody was so helpful. They couldn't have been nicer. We did a lot of private skiing in January. Just ski, ski, ski. Bell Mountain, all this. I had to learn to ski in deep snow. That was something I was not used to.
Did you also learn how to turn a little rather than shushing down?
Yes. But in the deep snow, I still went rather straight than turning. You have to, if you come from Europe, you are used to ice and hard conditions, and especially as a racer, it's a prepared slope, it's a hard slope. I mean, you had to sharpen your edges constantly. There was no need to sharpen your edges here. It was just like butter to ski over that whole terrain. Just beautiful.
How old was your daughter when she first started skiing?
Renata was 5. I didn't want to start her any earlier. I always believed that children should at least be able to put their ski clothes on by themselves before you drag them out there.
I know that you taught in the Aspen Ski School, but did you have any jobs in Aspen before you began teaching?
I did. My English was very spotty. I could say verses like early to bed and early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise, which doesn't help very much. But I wanted to improve it. And there were not many jobs available for somebody who has a child. So I worked in the Hillside Lodge as a maid for 8 months. I made 42 beds a day. I still cannot imagine it anymore how I did it. Up and down the stairs, Renate on the left side, the vacuum cleaner and stuff on the right. But I was so darn ambitious, I wanted to do it, and I wanted to do it right. And I got 78 cents an hour. So that was the beginning.
And then soon after that, your son was born in 1954. What is his name?
It's Anton, Tony,
and
short.
And so now you have 2 children, and maybe we could talk just a little bit about what it was like raising children in Aspen in the 50s and the 60s.
Well, we had, by that time, quite a few friends who had children the same age. And so a lot of time we got to get in our yard or out in, in some of our parks, future parks, really. And we hiked a lot. When the children were little, we put a rucksack on, Mary Hayes and Gloria Shepherd and Pauline Peterson, all these people, we did a lot with our children. We had wonderful summers.
Was it a good environment to raise children?
Very good. Excellent. And we did not coddle them, we let the kids run. They were There was no reason to think that anything can happen to them. We didn't think that way, period. Even when I think today, when they stayed out the first time camping, and we couldn't sleep because we couldn't think, here's an 8-year-old camping out there someplace. We don't know the exact location. It wasn't a comfortable feeling. But this is how the kids grew up and learned.
And did you live at the home where you live now at 320 West Hallam?
Yeah, we lived here.
And the kids would walk into town and...
The school was just down the road, so it was very convenient. Always walking. We're old walkers.
Anything else about raising children in Aspen? Their experiences that you might want to mention?
Well, they got into the typical 1960 trouble with the drugs, with marijuana and so on. But lucky for us, my son had such a violent reaction that he had to be brought to the emergency room, and I think it did it for life. He knows that he's allergic to all these things.
That was lucky.
Very lucky. He was 14 at the time.
So even in those days, in the 60s, of course,
yeah,
there was those opportunities.
Oh, yeah.
For kids.
Very much.
All right, let's back up a little bit and talk about your career when you were teaching skiing. I believe you began about 1955, is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
So your son was about a year old?
Right.
And let's talk a little bit about the ski school in those days. First of all, I wonder, were there any other women teaching?
Yeah, there was Selma Sabatini, and there were a few other ladies in there. But they didn't stay. I stayed. And I loved to teach. I really loved it till the day I stopped. That was one of my favorite occupations, to see how people improve and having a good time. Usually I taught in the morning, and we had a good time skiing in the afternoon, and this way the people really truly improved. Plus once I had the people, I had the returning customers till I stopped.
Did you teach private lessons in those days, or were there classes?
No, I taught classes first, and then I was, I don't remember the year, but it must have been about 56, around there, 56, 57. I was the first woman teacher who was allowed really fast classes, expert classes, and that really was a thrill.
How did the ski school, I guess Friedel Pfeiffer was in charge, is
yeah,
that right? And Sepp was also teaching?
Sepp was teaching, yeah, he was always in upper classes.
What kind of instruction or clinics did they give you as instructors so that you could teach according to the method that was prevalent in those days?
Well, we had the rotation technique, which naturally was pretty much the opposite what we skied when we came from Europe. But I liked it. It was fun teaching. You made the widest turns, elegant looking. Sepp never quite changed. He might have moved his arms, but his legs went the Arlberg way. So, no, I didn't mind the rotation technique.
And did they have clinics in those days for
they
instructors?
They had clinics every beginning of December. And pretty soon I was a group leader. I enjoyed very much teaching instructors. And there are quite a few still working in the ski school who started with me.
Do you remember any names now?
Well, Steen Gansel and Martha Madsen, two who come to mind immediately. They were, anyway, they are the ones I remember immediately.
Any stories about teaching skiing in the 50s and the 60s, maybe about the clients or the equipment or what happened on the slopes or anything like that?
Yeah, I had a lot of stuff happening. I had one lady who, well-known lady in Aspen really, who was just before a divorce, didn't want to have a divorce, and said, that was a private lesson, and said, if I could just break my leg that my husband has to care for me, I would just happily do it. But she didn't even have to try. We went into Spar Gulch, and as we got into Spar Gulch, there were some groups from the ski snowcats, and she didn't get out of one of them and did break her leg. And I have never seen anything like this, because she was not unhappy about it. She cried, but she wasn't unhappy. That's kind of unusual. And then I had a class once, all psychiatrists from Chicago. It was an interesting class. They didn't fit together really in skiing, but it was quite a conversation going in this group.
Did they analyze their skiing and interpret what they were doing?
I must say, it was really funny, because seven of them were psychiatrists and one was a medicine student, the son of a very famous surgeon in Chicago. He was 23 years old, and he didn't fit at all into the class. Tall guy, heavy guy. But because he was that famous son, that son of a famous surgeon, the other gentleman wanted me to keep him in class. So we had to do simple terrain, like one and two leaf. And as we got down one and two leaf, he fell and he unhooked his shoulder. He dislocated his shoulder, screamed, hit the ground. And as he hit the ground, he said, I'm going to die. God bless America. And that made me so mad. In the meantime, the ski patrol came. He didn't take any Demerol. He didn't take any medication. And when I think of it, if I would do this today, I would be sued. But at that time, I pulled him up, let the ski patrol stand back, plucked his nose, and in a moment he opened his mouth. I threw the pills, two pills in, and stuffed his mouth with snow, and he swallowed it. I gave him such a lecture about being such a sissy. And to my upset, I found out afterwards that that guy had a trick shoulder. If he would have said anything about that, that could have been fixed right on the spot. So next day he came over to the meeting place with the shoulder in a sling, and he gave me one of these beautiful Herbert Bayer snowflake pins, saying in a nice little letter, you made a man out of me.
So I bet there's a lot of these stories that you have over the years.
Oh, I could write a book.
Yeah. Anything else come to mind?
No, I don't want to, really.
Okay, all right. As you think back over your 10 or 11 years seasons as a ski instructor in the Aspen Ski School, how did this school change over the years?
Well, Fred went out to Buttermilk. When Friedland Fred split up, Fred went out to Buttermilk.
Fred Iselin,
yeah. He went out there to create a new ski school. And after some back and forth, I went with him under the condition that I could ski Sundays over on Aspen Mountain, because I didn't want to lose my touch. But I loved to work under Fred. He inspired people. He was a fun guy. He was just something which is very rare now. Special personality. And when I think that he always looked over to Highlands and said, look at this Mickey Mouse Mountain, and then 2 years later he is the
director
of the ski school over there. That's kind of funny.
Did you and Sepp have a chance to ski when you weren't working? Did you ski together?
We rarely skied together, because we were both too much. We were too ambitious. When we skied down, one wanted to beat the other one down the mountain, and sometimes it was too close to a collision. So we decided not to ski too much to the very end. Didn't ski much together.
Did you ski with your kids?
Skied with the kids. But they were pretty good skiers, too.
Okay, And then I also read something about your involvement as a professional instructor. What was that?
Well, there was a time the Southern Rocky Mountain Ski Instructors Association was voting for a new director. And we never had a woman in it. So I got up and said, I think it's high time we have a lady in this group. We have already quite a few women instructors throughout Colorado, and I think our voice has to be heard. So naturally they said, well, why don't you do it? And they brought it to a vote, and it went over 100%. So for 3 years I was one of the lady directors of Southern Rocky Mountain, and changed some of the laws because we had to still go through an examination for a whole week, writing a thesis over 5,000 words, which is like a doctor's work, and which is history itself. And it was too expensive for most of us.
And that was different than men? Or was it for
everybody?
No,
it was for everybody, but it really was too expensive, staying over there a whole week, really having an examination like a state exam for something special. And very strict, very hard. And I thought, any instructor who goes to an examination, goes through ski school clinics ahead of time, is very well prepared, and most of them really know what they are doing. And a good examiner, and they are good, can tell after 2 days if a guy is good or not, if he can explain himself, if he's fun, if he can make a good combination teacher and entertainer, really, in a way. And so now it's a weekend, which helps a tremendous amount, I think. But I enjoyed being part of this group. I met so many really interesting people. And this year, for example, when we had the get-together of all the old-timers from the PSIA, which was here in Aspen, it was really nice to see Doug Pfeiffer and Erich Windisch, all these old-timers who really had something to say in the creation of American skiing.
And a lot of that happened here.
You're here and also Sun Valley. Mm-hmm. Not there, but other areas too.
What prompted you to leave the ski school as an instructor?
I am quite an impulsive person, so I was booked up for the whole season, really. And I had heard through the grapevine that the ski corp intends to put a restaurant up into Turlot Park. So in February of 66, exactly on the 23rd, I asked if I could be excused from the meeting place and just quick run up to Darcy Brown and said, the next restaurant you are building, I am so interested, I really would love to run it. And he was so taken aback, he said, why would you want to do this, and what is your background, really? And I told him that I grew up in the business, then I went to also commercial school, and by watching what's going on in most mountain restaurants, I just thought this would be such a challenge to change it. And so in June, Darcy called me from Carbondale and said, I pick you up, and he brought me up to the restaurant where the foundation was laid already, and I met Harry Pratt, his builder, and anyway, by December I had my lease, and December 22nd in 66 I opened with an all-ladies crew, all my friends working up there, and the first people who came in, it was really very funny, they were a couple from Red Mountain. And I have to think of their name. I see them still. And they said, my God, are we in the new restaurant or is this the PTA meeting? That's funny.
How did you get So you said you wanted to run the restaurant and you had had some experience, yeah. But this was a brand new restaurant. How did you go about organizing it and getting it ready to open?
This is what I like the most. I love organizing. And so I went ahead just making all the drawings the way I wanted it, the way it should be. So, because I didn't like it that in most restaurants the hot stuff was in the beginning and the cold stuff was at the end, and then you go out to the cash register and everything is lukewarm. So we moved all the hot things up toward the cash register and dessert and cold stuff to the beginning of the line. But then at that time, you wouldn't believe it, but there was just the original building, and there was just a small, comparatively small stove, and about a workboard of a little over a meter. And that's where I did all my cooking and baking. But then we didn't have more than about 500 people a day. I was not allowed to make any advertising. There wasn't even a directional shield up on the mountain. I should have been a catch-all for the overflow of the Sunday. But this I didn't want to do. I just thought, no. I want to show that different food can be served on a mountain. It can all be fresh. It can all be done. And I went ahead and started to make absolutely different food. European, American, mixing it. Also, we were one of the first ones who had vegetarian meals. But we never told the people the day before what we would serve the next day. We changed every single day. We didn't repeat ourselves. And then by accident one day, the lift was closed because we had a snowstorm. I made for my employees, I made a strudel. And they said, "Ah, this is delicious. Couldn't you sell that?" So,
and that was the beginning.
By that time, that was the beginning, but we hand-peeled and hand-sliced the whole thing. Mm. But I always, up to the very last, I made my own dose. Mm. I always did. And anyway, that was the beginning of that.
Gretel, I want to talk a lot more about the restaurant, but it's almost time to turn the tape over. Before we do, what was the name of the restaurant?
It was Gretel's on Turtle Park.
And did you eventually, or when did you get some signing so that people would know about you?
4 years later. Mm-hmm. I was on a salary for 4 years, and after that I did ask to get at least on a certain percentage, and I was the only restaurateur on Aspen Mountains who had to pay 15% of the gross. For most of the years I was up there, while the rest paid between 10 and 12.
Let's turn the tape over and continue.
Yeah.
Gretel, we were just talking about the Ski Corps. It was, in those days, it was the Aspen Skiing Corporation. And what kind of relationship did you have with them over the years?
I had a really good one. I liked Darcy.
And it was Darcy Brown.
Darcy Brown was a man. If he said something, he kept his word. He was one of the old guard still.
I'm a little bit confused. When you said you went into the original building, was there something prior to what now is the restaurant in that place?
No. The original building was just a big rectangular building, which later on a kitchen got added. They added on a kitchen, and they added on the room where the sandwiches were made, plus some new storage, and naturally the deck out there. And an apartment. This all happened over a few years.
So you started with a very small
stove. With the base building.
And a very small
working area.
Mm-hmm. Did someone help you do the cooking?
No, I had people who cut stuff.
The prep stuff.
The prep stuff, but No, I'm at that time I made most of it myself.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned that part of your vision for the restaurant was to provide a different kind of food and right. and something that was of higher quality and quantity mm-hmm. than the existing restaurants on the mountain. What were some of your ideas about how you thought employees should be treated?
It was on a very personal basis. I picked people who complimented each other, mostly local people. I'm still in very close contact with all of them. We became, in a short time, a very close-knit family, really. And we ended up having, I had year after year, 36 employees on a rotating basis. Wonderful people. I had in this whole 14 years, I had to fire only two. And one is in business herself now. We just had clashing personalities.
Is she in the restaurant business?
No, but something
like that.
Like it, really. And the other one is a young man who just thought he could help himself running a cash register the proper way by letting the first few people go through free, so he would have a little starting money if he does something wrong. And in the moment I had my eyes, they always said I have eyes in the back too, and in the moment I saw this, I had him go. But this young man kept calling and saying he would never ever do something like this again. Please take me back. So I have to say, after 4 days, I took him back. He was such a good worker, but I never put him on the cash register again. He was back on the grill by that time. He couldn't do any damage.
Did you have any models in your mind or restaurants you had seen that helped you?
No, I didn't. I wanted to do something absolutely original. I wanted to do it my way. By teaching and being in various ski areas, I thought what I wouldn't do, how I would do it. So I wrote this stuff down and then made drawings and did it. And I must say it ran absolutely beautiful. It ran like a household, really.
What were some of the things that you knew that you wouldn't want in your restaurant?
Poor quality, number one. The best quality is basically for a person who operates a business the cheapest, because there's nothing to throw away. And anything cheap or what the sellers consider a deal, you have to sort out. You need people to do it, which costs you. Plus, it doesn't have the taste. Just isn't half as good. The fresher it is, the better it is. The best quality is really, the best is the best. It's easier to handle.
And what do you remember about opening day?
We had such, all of us, not only me, we had such butterflies you cannot imagine. We were scared to death that we'd do something wrong, that it wouldn't run, that a machine would conk out. We just were scared to death. But it all worked. So the next day already went smoother, and then it really was plain word by mouth. Because, like I said, we were not allowed any advertising. But the word got around very fast.
Are there some stories that you have about things that happened while you were running the restaurant that may have been a little unusual?
We had a lot of parties up there. We had a lot of celebrities who we really didn't bother, but who would make a point of meeting me eventually and being quite happy that they could be incognito up there. That included movie stars and government people, and naturally, I have to say, Prince Faisal and the King of Spain, and all these people came and they wanted to get to know you, and you sat down with them and had a cup of tea or talked, because they were familiar through magazines and newspapers. Anyway, I met the most interesting people, and a lot of these people have become lifelong friends.
Anybody come to mind?
Well, Chuck Nicholson, for one. He really liked to be up there and enjoyed very much our company up there. As a matter of fact, one day he stayed over, he asked if he couldn't ski down with my crew. And we sat around the round table, and Sally Mensmer, all of us, we asked all kind of funny questions, but Sally most particularly, because we wondered about his clothes. He was never exactly a fashion model. And Sally just asked point blank where he buys it, if it come from the thrift shop. And he just laughs, his usual nice laugh. And I have to say, George Hamilton always kissed my hand and was just lovely. And then the Kennedys were up there, lots. As a matter of fact, Edel gave me a beautiful book about Robert Kennedy with an inscription, which I cherish. And naturally all the football players and so many people. Would be interesting ones to put down their names. I have it all in newspaper clippings and so on. I have stacks of it. And then one day in 1978, the Bavarian television and radio came over to us, went up to the restaurant unannounced, and made a movie. It was a movie which is called Skiing Between Pole and Palms, which meant from the North Pole, or winter skiing, Palms meant Hawaii. They started in Taos and ended up in Hawaii. And that movie turned out really beautiful, I must say. I have some copies here. And run in Europe for 22 times on television and so on. And anyway, I met a lot of people because of it.
And I bet a lot of people came skiing in Aspen because of it.
The face. Yeah.
Any other memories of perhaps a day when something had gone wrong, or?
Oh yeah, we had one particular day sticks in mind. It was snowing and blowing, and some people had been up on a mountain already, so the mountain had to be closed. So most people came in. The place was absolutely full. And because there was such a fun group up there, there were partly European people. I had an accordion up there and the guitar, and brought it up, and we made a big party. We gave the food away for free and just had a ball. And by the way, giving the food away free, we did this every year, end of the season. The last day we were open, which was usually around the 31st of March, we closed earlier than the Sunday. We had announced on the blackboards to come up and have free food up at our place, because we just didn't want to have anything left. And then the next day, by invitation, I had a huge big party up there with approximately 300 people, also non-skiers who were brought up in snowcats. And I had year after year, and had a group of musicians up there playing for us to dance. And days ahead already, I baked and froze torts and stuff. We had the best food you can imagine. It was just beautiful. We danced, we had plays, we had a ball. When I think of it, had a wonderful time. Then also we stayed up quite often up at full moon time. Stayed at the restaurant, brought our sleeping bags up.
That would be your family?
No, the employees. And I hired somebody to, actually PJ, Paul Johnson, who has a business in town here. He was working for me, but I hired him for the night to make us dinner, while we walked over to the top of number 8 and had drinks and watched the sun go down, and then slid down on trays to the restaurant.
Oh,
Oh, we had such nice times.
As the years went on, did you have more people help with preparation, and did you do a little less in the kitchen? Or
yes,
did you?
I did less, but I had the best people. Mm-hmm. I trained them very well. I had excellent people working for me, and mostly people from town.
Mm-hmm. And the same people year after year?
Year after year. That was wonderful. I think that's why we are so close mm-hmm. at this moment still.
Did you see, as you looked at other mountain restaurants in this area, that Gretel's influenced them?
Yes, absolutely.
In what way?
Different food service, they changed. They adopted, and especially Snowmass also. And then after I quit up there, 2 years later, I was asked by a group of young men from Park City to be their consultant and help them with the snow hut in Park City. I flew up there a few times, gave them all the suggestions. It was not a user-friendly restaurant. There was no traffic flow in it. Absolutely none, zero. And I had all these ideas. And we wrote a proposal. And in August of 82, I got a phone call from one of these gentlemen saying they had a meeting, and after I could not commit myself to really work up there, I would have committed just to fly up once a month and teach the key people. They didn't get it. And I was on a Friday in August, and I said, well, I felt so sorry because the guys had such enthusiasm. They are wonderful people. And I said, don't hang up. I know two places you can apply, and one of them I would really help you. I said, one is Beaver Creek. Make an application. The other one is Aspen Highlands. Their lease is up. They are not renewing it. I know for sure if I give you a hand, you can get in. Hang up, call them. And they called George Lloyd. And George Lloyd called me, it's always in an hour. And I said, that was Friday. The guys came Sunday, because I had to talk with them and get everything straightened out. And Monday we went up the mountain, looked the restaurant over, told them I need windows in the kitchen, I cannot work in a dark room. And Tuesday we signed the lease. And I had complete quality control for 5 years up there.
And did you actually work in the restaurant?
I worked like it was mine. Mm-hmm. I taught the guys. First there were three, then now there are two. And they're still up there
and
doing a really
names?
Good job.
I'm sorry, what
That's
are names?
George Germerhorn and Robert Cronenberg, doing a really terrific job.
Well, let's back up just a little bit, because we have to get from the closing of Gretel's restaurant to what happened, what you described in Park City, and then the merry-go-round, which is the name of the restaurant in the Highlands. How did it happen that this successful, marvelous, delicious restaurant closed?
That is still a puzzle to me. I hope one day somebody will tell me what really, truly happened, what the story really is. I received a lease which was absolutely unacceptable. It would have ruined me financially. I couldn't do it. If I would have agreed, I would have worked for nothing. I still just plain cannot understand what happened and who the person really is who wanted me out that badly. But apparently somebody was there who didn't like it, that we were so successful. We were written up in, you wouldn't believe it, there isn't a magazine from the New York Times to the Chicago Tribune to the Los Angeles Times to Women Wear Daily to Town and Country. I cannot even start. We had write-ups, we had people up there from all over Europe. I had once a whole group of, from the mayor of Innsbruck to restaurant owners from Vorarlberg, all these people coming up, or a whole contingent coming over from Vail. from the food and beverage manager to the people who work close up on the mountain. All these people wanted to know things, and I was always willing to give a hand and to give my ideas. I never charged a penny for that, and I can was with Telluride, with Steamboat, you name it. I was involved in so many things, and to this day I don't know. One nice thing was that after I had to resign. There was no other way.
And this was 1980?
Yeah. There was
toward the end of the ski season?
To the end of the ski season. It was in February. And I just, to this day, I don't know what was truly behind it. I can guess, but I cannot put my finger on, really.
And there's nobody that's
and
told
I was
you?
So, no. Mm-hmm. I was nearly sick. I was heart sick. And at that time, I have a whole notebook full of offers which came my way at that time. And that means from the Red Onion to the Copper Kettle to all these places, to out-of-town places. One wonderful one was really by Edgar Stern from Deer Valley. First Park City, then Deer Valley. He wanted me really in the beginning when they built and flew me up there. And it was... They outdid themselves to show me what I could do up there. But they made an offer which was unreal. But I didn't want to move from Aspen. Just didn't. So it was a really, for me, a terrible time. I had to rethink my life practically, because this was something I lived for. I loved it. I loved my people, I loved the people who came. You wouldn't know how many meals we made because people asked for it. Or somebody was sick, we made them something special on the side. Or somebody of the school teachers called and said, I'm on this and that diet, would you be so nice? We are coming up today. We absolutely did what a restaurant actually should do, please the customers. And so it was a real shocker. But then getting involved at Highlands, that really helped me personally too. And the guys were good to work with. Part of my crew went over there just to get them started. And I like what I see over there. I still like to help people. I still get telephone calls and questions from God knows where, including California and so on. And I have always been free with advice, and I hope it was always, I know it was always a help to the people.
So it was a real shock, and I imagine it was a shock in the community as well.
It was.
What kinds of response did you get from people?
I got so many letters and also newspaper write-ups about it, which, and this means it went, the papers came from all over the United States, really, because people asked themselves, why? I couldn't answer it.
Mm-hmm. Well, so your life changed a great deal.
Yeah.
And then after 5 years, you left the merry-go-round in good hands. Is that how you feel about it? Or?
Well, it wasn't really 5 years. Well, it was longer than that. But I stayed on longer. Mm-hmm. I really, truly enjoyed working with these guys. But eventually I felt that I'm hanging on to something which I shouldn't. They needed the freedom to make their own choices. It was only fair to leave.
Well, then let's look for a little while at your life in Aspen, primarily after the restaurants. Although perhaps even, let me back up just a little bit. Throughout these years, you were working very hard in the restaurant, but I wonder if there's anything you'd like to say about your life as a mother and a wife in Aspen, and maybe a little bit about what you did in town, in addition to the restaurant, if you had time.
Yes, I did, naturally. One thing is I love to travel, and I really mean travel, short distance, long distance, you name it. I am ready to go at any time, and just came back from Brazil. Have traveled quite a bit in Russia and Siberia, Mongolia, Europe naturally. Just love it. And then in Aspen, well, one thing I always did, I gave a lot of parties. I love parties, and I like people. And one which particularly became famous was my garden party. Started it many, many years ago, when we were all still young, always on the 20th of July. That's my name day. And so I was so lucky. All these many, many years, that was that it never rained on my party.
How many years did you give it?
Oh, oh God, from the end 50s till 3 years ago. But it's so much work you wouldn't believe. I have a tent and I made food. I cooked at least for 4 days, cooked and baked and cooked and baked. And I invited between 70 and 90 ladies. They all had to wear something very summerly, including hats. In the beginning, they made their hats or brought it from the thrift shop, and everybody was watching how the next one looks when they came in. Really fun. I have the nicest pictures and memories of that time. And then end of the lunch, which lasted usually till 5, I put the paper plates out and wrapping paper, and they had to take it all home. And believe me, there was a lot to take home to their husbands and children. So there was not too much left to clear up.
Did you ever have anyone help you with the cooking for a big party like that?
No.
All yourself?
Yeah. But I think if somebody would help me, and they certainly have offered, I think I should do it once in a while again. It's just, you wouldn't believe it. It's so much work. It's incredible.
I can imagine. What was your social life like during the years that you and Sepp lived here?
It was great. Absolutely fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. Aspen was a real party town and still is. I love parties. I like to go out. I still do. Wild parties. Really crazy stuff, fun stuff. You wouldn't believe it.
When you think about the 50s and the 60s, was there a big mix of people in town in terms of those who were here for the cultural events and those who were the skiers and those who were working every day and those who were more wealthy? Was the stratification or was there a mix in the social life?
There was
life?
An absolute 100% mix. And that was so wonderful. You liked people for their personality. You didn't care if they are rich or poor or whatever they are. As long as they had humor and could manage their life and contribute something to this community, we had all such a wonderful time. Nobody thought of money. It didn't occur. If you had it or didn't have it, we mixed with absolutely everything. That was the nice part.
I know that, I read that Sepp had a stroke in 1994 that he recovered from.
Yeah.
Is that correct? And that he died just almost two years ago.
Yeah.
On August 23rd, 1993. You'd been married 45 years, and I'm wondering if there's anything you'd like to say about that difficult time and how your life has changed since then.
Sepp was a very special person. He was a person very much to himself. Even he was quite an entertainer when he felt like it. But basically, he was a man who liked to work in his workshop out there, undisturbed. He could even forget about food and eating. I think that's why I like to cook so much for other people, because he was so fussy. But he was truly, I can only say, except all our married life, he was a true gentleman. And never varied in that respect. And I always admire him for the courage he had. Certain days before he died, he just told me, this is it, this life cannot go on like this. That isn't life. The quality is lost. I couldn't go back to skiing this winter. I cannot do drawings anymore or paintings the way I like to do it. I like to quit. And he said, this is something you have to understand, because you are made of the same mold, you would do the same. And he threw away all his medication on that day. And Dr. Mink was so nice to told me the consequences the next day. And Sepp still saw all his friends this last 13 days. Everybody was here in the house. We always had a full house. And I let just always one person at a time go into his room. I had him downstairs. He was unbelievable till the day he died. Very conscious of everything, but absolutely willing to go. So I really admire him to have such courage. He loved music, so do I. We made a lot of music at the house. We had so many good times.
Well, I know that it's both painful,
yeah, it is,
to think about it now because of the loss. And I appreciate your sharing that. Gretel, what was the ultimate cause of his death?
Sepp had congestive heart failure. There was still a medication on the market, a new one, which would have shrunk the heart. But Sepp had made up his mind. It's time to go. He said, we had such a wonderful life. I cannot live under the circumstances. I don't want to. And Sepp left a beautiful, beautiful letter where he just really thanked me for this whole life and wished me the best and said, feel free, like you always, just feel free to travel and do what you really like to do. I think that's great.
And yet, as you were telling me when we had the tape off, you were really hoping that he would have, part of you was hoping that he would have fought, because you thought maybe he had a chance.
Yes, I drove Sepp to Denver a few times and I really talked him into it, or tried to talk him into it. But Sepp had made up his mind, and it was hard for me to understand, because I'm a fighter. I like to do things all the way. I really don't like to give up. What really helps me tremendous amount are all our friends in Aspen, and actually all over, not just Aspen. I have such an incredible support group of friends. I cannot believe it, and I'm so thankful for it. I can tell you, I'm just so blessed with it. Now people just keep looking out for me, and I am living an absolutely good life.
Let's take a few of our last moments now to talk about looking back at your life in Aspen from the perspective of over more than 40 years here. What do you see as your most important accomplishments during your life in Aspen? Personally or professionally?
Personally, to holding a family together under sometimes very trying circumstances. I have a daughter who has PKU, which is a protein deficiency, and affects her very much. So she has a hard life, and which means I have a lot of responsibility. I have an incredibly artistic son who is my biggest support. I can only say he really lights up my life, and not just mine, I think quite a few people's. Anyway, I think the whole thing is a give and take all along in your life, and in ASPM it's very easy to do. And another thing I love about ASPM so very much is meeting the most interesting people and truly becoming acquainted with them. Not just on a cocktail party circuit, but really getting to know them. And that's what I cherish. People are stopping by. I always have an open house. I always bake something. I always have something here. People know they can drop in at any time. I will always have the time, or most of the time I have the time for them. And I love it. I never know who comes, but everybody is welcome to come. It makes for a really good conversation and a beautiful life.
Do you have any, well, I know you must have some thoughts, but what are some of your thoughts about the growth of the town?
What bothers me, and I like to really speak out on that, is that people who lived here for such a long time, like ourselves, are absolutely not considered when it comes to property tax. We are not here for speculation. We are here to outlive our life here. Why make it so hard on us? Why should we? My house is such that I cannot rent it out because it doesn't have heat in various rooms. It's an old house from 1888, and it would be very hard to change anything in it, to make it rentable like so many people do, to get at least their tax money. I cannot do that. And I think we should be on something which keeps it at a certain level, and the increase should be according to the national growth and not just to the whim of some of our politicians.
Is that something you discuss with your friends and other people?
Yes, I do. And I also go to the hearings. But that doesn't seem to matter. There is no strong voice here who helps people. Actually, in that case, old-timers. Mm-hmm. We are slowly but surely moved out. Only I don't want to. Again, I will be here till I die, I hope. And I will find one way or another to keep the house. Mm-hmm. I will. So, but I know other people have a hard time.
And there are people who are leaving.
A lot of people are leaving.
Mm-hmm. And you think this is one of the reasons? The
Absolutely.
Financially?
Yes, it is. It is. No.
You've also seen a lot of changes in the ski industry since you came in the early 50s.
Yeah.
How do you characterize the ASPM skiing industry?
Well, the town has grown so much that it is unnatural what followed. It just is, the development is just like in any of the European resorts, follows absolutely in the same footsteps, and it's, you cannot hold it back. Only in Europe, they do take care of the people who live there. Mm-hmm. While in ASPM, we don't. We just ignore that fact.
Do you have any idea why that is here?
No, I don't. I don't.
Well, Greta, we're coming to the end of our time. We have maybe a few more minutes. And I know that you have been interviewed many times for the restaurant and perhaps for the Historical Society. If you were asking yourself some questions, is there anything that I haven't asked you that should be asked? Or anything you'd like to mention that we haven't had a chance to talk about?
No, I can only say I love my life here. I wouldn't want it any different. I'd like to outlive it here. Naturally, interspersed with all the travel I'm doing. But home is here, 100%. And my friends are here. Makes all the difference. I just can say, I cherish my friends. No, I love Aspen.
And what do you think you have left as a legacy or a mark on Aspen? Or what do you hope that you have left over all these years?
I hope that I think a good spirit and being ready to jump in at any time when there is need. I don't like to be on any volunteer basis, but everybody knows that whatever comes up, I'm the first one to jump in. There is never a question asked, I do it. But I don't like to be on a timetable. I absolutely hate timetables. I have been on schedule all my life, and this I don't want anymore. I think the only thing I'm on a time schedule in winter is my senior group, to ski with them, and that's the only one I keep.
What kind of skiing do you do now, or how often do you ski with your senior group?
I ski with the senior group, I ski once a week, and I was assigned to Highlands last year. The year before I was on Buttermilk with them. I would like to see a change that we can bring our group every week, that we exchange, that we bring the group to each of the areas the following week, so we get to know all areas and still can keep together or be together with the same type of people.
So are you instructing now, or are you just being as a friend?
I usually do a little bit of instructing when I have a group, because I see what's missing naturally, and I'm always a little critical. But basically I ski with them, and we have truly a wonderful time. And there are people from out of town who report to the senior center and join us. And sometimes I have to split the group because there are so many. But then I take it one part of it in the morning, the other part in the afternoon. And we do get together.
Is there anything else that you would like to add before we finish today?
What made me happy really is that the food industry in Colorado really has slowly gone the direction I pointed. And we had a wonderful write-up in the Rocky Mountain News about that years ago, which I have kept naturally. I really know that it can be done no matter how many people. We had days where we served 2,000 people, we had days where we served only 1,200 or so, but we never, ever skipped on quality. Never. I would never do it. I would never water down the soup or do something like this, which is done, or use second quality. I think that's, well, quality is quality no matter what.
True.
Goes through your whole life.
And it, as you've demonstrated and as you've explained to me, it not only played a role in your food, but also in the rest of the quality of your life, your friendships, your relationships,
yeah.
And everything that you've done.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
It goes through the whole life.
Well, I would like to thank you and tell you what a pleasure it has been for me to have a chance to ask you questions and to be with you and to help you to tell your story. And I just want to thank you again.
Thank you a lot.
Okay.